a storied franchise.
And the New York Islanders have won their fourth straight Stanley Cup.
All-time NHL greats.
And he caught that over the line. Goes to the left side, shoots and scores! He is all alone as the leading NHL goal-scoring defenseman.
Tonelli to Nystrom, he scores! Bob Nystrom scores the goal! The Islanders win the Stanley Cup!
This is Talkin' Isles with Greg Bicker and Corey Wright.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Talkin' Isles, the New York Islanders interview-based podcast. My name is Corey Wright, senior writer for NewYorkIslanders.com, and as always, I'm joined by Greg Picker, the radio color commentary voice of the New York Islanders. And Greg, this week I think we had one of the game's great storytellers on the podcast.
That is absolutely the way to define, especially his post-playing career. Chico Resch joined us on Talkin' Isles this week, and boy, can he tell a story.
Chico had plenty of stories ranging from that 1972 training camp to 1975. He's interacted with a lot of the great personalities in the game. And really, as far as goaltenders go, he's been a pretty good one historically for the New York Islanders. His 25 shutouts are still the franchise record. And you consider how, you know, small his gear was back in the day and how tough goaltending has been in that high-flying, high-scoring 70s and 80s. Just really impressive. And it was a pleasure to get to talk to him about a variety of topics. And we will take it away with former Islanders goaltender Glenn Chico Resch.
Bill Barber is back in his own zone contemplating this. And once he starts, he's starting up and he's picked up the puck. In across the line, Resch moves out. Barber fakes him. A shot is tipped out and Resch makes the big save. And Barber is beside himself.
Well, he tried to pull him out to Resch's right side. And Resch stayed with him and beat him as he tried to draw and hold long enough to get the puck over the downstretch goaltender.
And now we welcome in Glenn Chico Resch to Talkin' Isles. Of course, spent majority of his career playing with the Islanders, at least the first 282 games out of the 571 throughout his NHL career. Also spent time with the Colorado Rockies, New Jersey Devils, and Philadelphia Flyers. And Chico, these days we can hear you on the New Jersey Devils radio broadcasts, and not all that long ago, you were back in the Coliseum when the Devils wrapped up that portion of their schedule this year against the Islanders, and you really took in the Coliseum, maybe more than anybody else we saw that came through this year. Can you just speak to what that building meant to you and what that night was like when you got to say goodbye?
Well, you know, and I spent a couple more years in the minors just trying to claw and scratch my way to one day play with the New York Islanders. So I was in the organization like 8 years from really the very first training camp when we didn't have numbers on our jerseys. We had safety pins and we had a square flannel that had a number on and we had to pin them onto the back of our jerseys. I don't know why they didn't get them stenciled on, but anyway, that was the very humble beginning for the New York Islanders, but we were all proud to be a part of that. So I think why the Coliseum was so special, well, there were many reasons, but, you know, it was the first NHL rink that I really got to play in. You know, I remember the clock was just little. I mean, it was almost like you could have put, outside Coliseum building in process. Like, it wasn't really finished when we started the very first games of their existence. But anyway, make a long story short, by the time I made it, I remember that first year, and we could start beating teams, not just the Rangers, but we could beat teams that were pretty good teams. And at home, we could be more physical. We had a pretty physical team early on. I mean, and that building rocked. Ugh. It was just so loud. And so then to hear it for the last time when I went there in the last regular season game, I mean, obviously it was sad. I was very moved. My daughter would come to the practice rink. She was 3, 4, 5 years old. Got her to skate on the Coliseum ice. I had friends who came in from Canada or somewhere else in the United States. And it was so different then. We'd practice. And I'd say, hey, bring your skates. And then after practice, all, you know, we'd stay around Johnny Tonelli and especially Johnny Tonelli, but Gary Hallett, Bobby Nystrom, we'd stay around, take extra shots for 20 minutes or so. And then my friends who were visiting I'd say, okay, come on down to the bench. And then we put their skates on and they could just play on the Coliseum ice. It wasn't a very busy building at that time in the early years. They did have the nets there for a couple of years, but I mean, it was a playground. It was a babysitting venue for the poor trainers. Players would bring their kids and we'd practice and the trainers would have to watch them in the dressing room until we were done. You know, so it just was so much more than some beautiful, glitzy building as the new building's going to be. And that's fine because that's just life has changed. But it just had a homey atmosphere. So that last game was, I just realized it's over. This building served its purpose. But, you know, you buy your first house and it's a great place to get started. And then you buy your second one and it's special too. But the first one is always has some special meanings that it just brought back a flood of memories. And I took a picture of me standing in the crease. I could look off and by this, let's see, it'd be the fourth year, second year that I was there, you just knew where the fans sat. People weren't giving up season tickets. They were coming. Yeah, I know him. I know her. I know that kid, that family. So it was just a family affair for the New York Islanders those early years. And I think as we saw in this year's playoff, it continued till the final game that old building had a special meaning for everyone.
And Chico, you know, sticking with the buildings here, you were talking about just kind of moving out, moving on to UBS. I'm curious whether you've driven by it at all on your way out to an Islander game or if you've seen any of the photos or perhaps taken a tour. I know they've given some to alumni. So just, you know, for you, where is your excitement level to see the Islanders finally getting a state-of-the-art building like UBS Arena?
Well, I mean, remember, we were always the little brother or little sister. We were always fighting to somehow gain the prestige or recognition of the New York Islanders. You know, there's four teams in the NHL. Well, they say New York Islanders, but really it was Long Island. That was the area. You know, Carolina has their own state. Florida has Southern Florida. And New Jersey kind of, again, has a state. But the Islanders, when we first came there, the New York Rangers were still training on Long Beach. So the new New York Islander fans, as well as we players, really were kind of having to share our space, if you will, Long Island with the Rangers. They had a huge presence. So you were so aware of trying to somehow get an edge on the Rangers and their fans. It was very difficult when we started to beat them. You know, that was a huge sense of pride for our fans and for the players. But now I've done the virtual tour of the new building at Belmont. It's come full circle. And now the real Taj Mahal, if you will, of hockey arenas sits right in Belmont Park. And so the Islanders fans can feel like, yeah, we are the ones that everybody else is looking now to reach. Whereas when we were first started, was always looking up at Madison Square Garden, the Rangers and their fans. But now it's the Rangers who are trying to chase the Islanders in all these different areas. So it's a great sense of pride, and it's going to be a lot of enjoyment. What I like, they're going to have a little like area where there's going to be memorabilia from those early years that you can look at and be reminded of. You know, and Lou Lamoriello organizing and planning the dressing room is just incredible. Just every little aspect that you would want in a hockey arena has been incorporated into this new facility. So the Islanders, not that we were ever cocky, well, maybe a little bit, especially after four cups, but they can strut their stuff now, and so can the fans, because, you know, they have something that I think the whole league is going to be envious of.
Now, Chico, if we go back to your beginnings, humble days in Saskatchewan, you ended up at University of Minnesota Duluth for your college hockey, and then to the Islanders from there. Can you just share your origin story leading you to the National Hockey League?
Well, I was under an old rule that there were only six teams when I'm a kid, and each of the teams, the Rangers sponsored Winnipeg, and Winnipeg had a junior team. Montreal Canadiens sponsored Regina, where I was from. Chicago Blackhawks sponsored Moose Jaw. So all these areas were sponsored by an NHL team. And when you sign to play minor hockey, when you're 12 years old, when I signed to play in the Regina Pats minor hockey system. It also tied me into the Montreal Canadiens that they own me. I mean, when you think about it, I mean, it was not, I don't know, it would never happen now. But back then, the sponsorship entitled them to any player that signed this card to own their rights. So when I came out of University of Minnesota Duluth, I knew I'd have to play for the Montreal Canadiens, at least to begin. I went to their training camp, had a really good year, but I went to the lowest minor leagues, Muskegon in Michigan, and they got a lot of the Montreal Canadiens winning Stanley Cups. Their American League team was very good, and they had so many good players. Then the third level was Muskegon, where I got sent. And the ironic part was there, I had a really good year there because Montreal had a lot of players. We won the championship, and it was very good. But what was happening was in Oakland, California, Bill Torrey was working for the Oakland Seals, which became the California Golden Seals. And one of the people working for Bill Torrey or working with Bill Torrey was this gentleman by the name of Bob Turner, who had coached me in Regina. He was now scouting for Oakland. He had won 5 Stanley Cups with the Montreal Canadiens, and he, along with Bill Torrey, became friends and so forth. So then Bill Torrey gets the promotion to be the general manager of the New York Islanders. And as any good person or general manager would do, he used his contacts. So he said to his scout, Bob Turner, "Hey, you got anybody that you think I should take a chance on?" And Bob Turner said, "Well, listen, there's this kid, Resch, who is playing in the Montreal Canadiens organization, had a great year in the minor leagues. If you can get him thrown in on a trade, I would do that." So the Bill Torrey made a trade with the Montreal Canadiens, and the big name was Dennis DeGiordi. He had played a while and had a reputation. And then there were a number of people that, quite honestly, when they would have seen my name, don't know who that is. So I was a throw-in, but, I mean, it was a game-changer because then I was able. Remember, I was working as a mailman in Regina, and I got a call. I went home for lunch, and I got a call from this Harry Ottenbright in Denver. And he says, "Hey," I was Glenn at the time. I didn't become Chico till I went to Long Island. But he said, "Listen, the New York Islanders made a trade for you," which I hadn't even heard about. "And I was wondering if you would let me represent you." And I've talked to Bill Torrey, their general manager, who I didn't know. And he wants to offer you a contract. What do you think? I said, "Well, yeah." So that's how I found out I was traded to the Islanders. And who Bill Torrey was. Anyway, make a long story short, I signed for 2 years with the Islanders. I remember it was a $12,500 signing bonus, which, you know, a new car was like $5,700 or $5,000 at that time. So it was a good bonus. And then I made the same for playing, signed those 2 years, and then went to that first training camp in Peterborough, Ontario. Al Arbour was not on the scene yet. I think Earl Ingerfield was our first coach. But anyway, that was the beginning. And, you know, like most expansion teams, you thought, "Oh, this is going to be a long process." But then, as you guys know, a couple of things happened that really were game changers for the faster development and championship of the New York Islanders. And that all took place in the next few years.
Chico, I didn't know the story about you becoming a mailman. It kind of harkens back. We talked to Bobby Nystrom a few months ago, and I think he was working in some town, I guess, in the prairies, or I can't remember if it was BC or Alberta, and he was in a similar spot where he found out he got drafted, I think, at the bar after work. So that's a great story. I'm curious. I've read a lot about that 1972 training camp. It seemed like a pretty zany one. I'm curious, you know, were you just see anything? Do you remember anything from that? I've heard stories about guys, you know, bypassing the runs and, you know, charging rookies to drive them down the road to the rink and just a lot of zany stuff. So, I mean, do you remember anything from that 72 camp?
Yeah, I remember a lot. I remember, you know, the dressing room, the equipment was just jammed in there. And then getting those sweaters. And we would scrimmage. And, of course, there's pinned on with – you had 4 safety pins to pin your number on. You go along the boards, you hit da-da-da-da, flying, flapping behind players. Some of them are coming right off. And, I mean, it wasn't a classy. You don't think, wow, this is the NHL. You really didn't think that it was like, you know, major league at that time. I mean, you knew that eventually when we traveled to New York, it would be a different situation. But yeah, we would all have to go down to this hotel and we'd eat there. And at that time, you guys got to understand, there were just really two classes of hockey players. There were the veterans, and we had a few veterans, you know, and then you had the young rookies. We didn't say anything. It was sort of like the old fraternities. You just did whatever the veterans told you, and that's why you hear some of that stuff. We stayed like two or three, just a regular motel. Wasn't like any fancy hotel. You'd walk to the rink and hope you got some decent equipment. I mean, it was low budget training camp, but at the same time, you know, like Eddie Westfall was there, and Eddie Westfall had won some Stanley Cups with the Bruins. So, ooh, Eddie Westfall's here, you know. Dennis DeJordy was there. You know, you remember that. And then they had this rule that if a player got kicked out of the faceoff circle, the opposing centerman would just be in there by himself. They'd put the puck on the dot, and then the referee would blow the whistle. And then, so obviously, that centerman won the draw cleanly. It was the stupidest rule. And what would happen was, so if you're attacking, say it was Chicago, we were playing Chicago in an exhibition game, their center iceman in our zone, in our defensive zone, he's center iceman, he gets the free draw and puts it back, say, to Dennis Hull, who's got a wicked big banana stick, and he could just one-time it. And you could do your homework on this, but I think this went on for like maybe, I don't even know if it was a whole week. It was probably only 5 days of training camp games. And then not only the goalies, but the defensemen said, hey, this somebody's going to get killed here. And they finally changed that rule where, you know, if you got thrown out, another member of your team would come in and try to win the faceoff. But that was the craziest thing I ever remember. So I remember that, bus rides, and then not getting chosen to go to Long Island, which, you know, they said you're going to go to the minor league. So I remember the disappointment in that. The other thing I remember, the hockey cards, Opeachy, and for that's a Canadian branch, and Topps came, and then they had this this blue background, and it was in this special room, and you're just hoping someone comes and says, hey, you know, the hockey cards want you to go into this room, they want to take your picture. And I would see a lot of guys going in there, but my name wasn't being called. And then right at the end, someone said, hey, they want you to take your picture. I thought, whoa. So I went in there, and that turned out to be later my rookie card. So I remember that. I mean, Terry Criss, who got traded that year to Philly, we were told that whole new training regiment was coming in, and we were going to do stretching, we were going to do like calisthenics. You know, hockey players never done that. The warm-up was you'd go out before practice and skate and stretch, and I remember some of those. And it, you know how people fight change. I mean, guys are giggling, they're not following through. I just remember Terry Criss was the leader, because he had played in St. Louis, and he was one of the veterans. And we were doing those crazy routines that now players would laugh at. So I just remember, even though it was not at NHL caliber height in terms of a lot of things, it was still magical. And we won inter-squad games. When we'd play each other, we would beat each other. So we thought, well, we might win some games. But as you guys know, that first year for the Islanders was pretty grim in terms of wins, and it was a really tough year, but it laid the groundwork for getting Denny Potvin, which was another game changer.
Some of those stories, absolutely tremendous. I mean, I don't know of anybody that's ever told me the face-off rule one, but understandable considering that rule lasted all of a week of exhibition games and training camp. But some other stories that you have to share. How did the name Chico come to be?
Well, so then I played the next year in New Haven, and oh, we were bad. Oh, I love New Haven. They had a new rink, and it was close to Long Island, so we'd go up and see. That's when I first saw the Coliseum, and that was magical, even though, remember, you guys know that, 7 to 10,000, except for the Ranger games, was about the norm for attendance that first year. And then I went to Fort Worth the next year, and that's when I got called up for two games, and first game I lost and at the California Golden Seals. It was in Oakland Coliseum, and they only had about 6,000 people. That didn't seem like an NHL game, but Al was coaching by then, Al Arbor, and Bill Torrey said, hey, we'll take you back to Long Island and play one more game. Came back, played against the North Stars, and we won 6-2. That was my first win. And then they said, hey, you know, the season's winding down. You go back and play, because we were in the playoffs with Fort Worth. So then I thought, well, am I going to make it to next year? And here's the interesting thing. It was Jerry Desjardins and Billy Smith were the goalies. And Jerry Desjardins, at the end of that year, now that was the second year of the Islanders, he got offered a pretty darn good contract by Bill Torrey. And if he had signed, you guys, there would be no me, at least not playing for the Islanders. But for some reason, he and his wife said, no, we got to get out of Long Island. And the Michigan Stags gave him a really good offer because he was an established NHLer. And World Hockey had started, and they would pinpoint and go after certain NHL players that they thought they had some appeal, and they'd give them pretty good contracts. And Jerry got a very generous contract for an NHL contract, you know, at that time. But he and his wife decided, no, we're getting out of Long Island. And, of course, the year was really tough. So then when that happened, then I knew, okay, I got a shot. Smitty and I had become friends, and there weren't any other NHL goalies there. I thought, you know what, if I have a good training camp, you know, I could make the team. And fortunately, I did. So anyway, one day we go to the rink. It was at Rakuten Rink, the old rink. And Dougie Rombo, he wasn't the greatest player, but he might have been one of the greatest storytellers. He was one of those guys you guys know and everybody knows in their circle. He was funny, and he could embellish and make it even funnier. So he is either – he's probably both frustrated with me, and he says, this guy's driving me crazy. He's speaking of me. He said, you know, when we just get here just before we have to, like a half an hour before. He says, I got to go find him. Somebody tells me he's up on the first floor talking, trying to learn Spanish there. Da-da-da-da-da. He makes it really funny. And Chico and the Man, Freddie Prinze, was a show on television, had a mustache. I look like him a little bit. And he said, look, he's a dumb Canadian, but let's let him be who he wants to be. We're going to call you Chico. And oh, the guys roared, right? The players laughed. And so then they liked that. And then I remember like on a Monday or Tuesday, all through practice, then they picked it up. Hey, Chico, try to stop this one. Hey, you know, da-da-da-da, Chico, you know, because it's a catchy little name. And then I played my first game, I don't know if it was Thursday or Saturday, at home. And the writers had been around, and they had heard the guys calling me all that. And then, so I guess they must have asked some people, maybe they even asked me, and I told them the story. So then after that game on Thursday or Saturday, I'm not sure which, in the newspapers, some of the writers started writing Glenn Chico Resch. And that was the beginning. And then it didn't happen the first month, but by the second month, it was Chico. I was being called that in the press, on TV, and then the fans picked it up. And when they started chanting Chico, Chico, I think that really solidified my nickname. And honestly, guys, it was one of the best things that ever happened to me, because people forget names, but they very seldom forget nicknames. And I'm always thankful to Doug Rombo for giving me that title. And it was one of the warm memories of having played for the Island.
So Chico, it's funny you bring up Jerry Desjardins. I know that after that first season, you could kind of go one of two ways. And Billy Smith said he just kind of loved the situation. He was playing a lot. I think he said he was also fighting a lot, which says a little bit about Billy. And I think that for Jerry, it was maybe just that experience of being shelled every night was probably one that he didn't enjoy. I think we even tried to ask him about it at an alumni weekend a couple of years ago, and he still maybe wasn't super thrilled to remember that first season. But that leads into Billy Smith. And, you know, you guys became goalie partners, you guys became friends, and I think you've even said yourself, on the surface, it seems a little bit like the Odd Couple, but, you know, what was your relationship like with Billy? And, you know, how did you two get along both personally and professionally?
Well, you know what? The biggest thing is we understood each other. I knew what Billy was all about, his personality. I knew that he was a good goalie. He had won the championship in Springfield. We had played together just a little bit in New Haven, but then he got called up. And here's what I would say, and Al Arbor was good too, because Al very early on said, look, I have confidence in both of you, and you expect coaches to say that. But he said, I really do. Doesn't mean I'm going to alternate you every game. Sometimes you're going to be hot, sometimes you're not, but you're always going to get a chance to get back in there, and you're going to have your period where you might play a few games in a row. So he set the table that it wasn't a competition. And then, quite honestly, what really was another big factor was Billy's wife, Debbie, is a sweetheart. And my wife, Diane's a sweetheart. They became friends because I won't get into it, but later on, as my career unfolded, I had a couple goalie partners whose wives were not very nice to my wife, but Debbie was a sweetheart. So Billy and I on the road, we would hang together. I remember if I wanted something from Al or whatever we wanted something, I'd get Smitty. I'd say, Smitty, go tell Al and Bill Torrey, we need this. And he would do that. Like, for instance, off-ice training was changing. And one of the things that the Islanders started to do in that third year of existence, my first year, was after practice, you'd go and do weights and stuff. You know, right? And they had bikes you had to ride, and Smitty didn't want to do that, and I didn't. I said, hey, you go tell Al and Bill that that's not good for goalies, doing weights and all that. What we'll do, we had a friend, Rick Elstein, over at the Syosset Tennis Club. I said, you tell them that we'll go over and play like an hour of tennis. It'll help us with our concentration, with our footwork, with our movement, da-da-da-da-da-da, right? And Smitty goes in, and he gives me the thumbs up. We're on. So then we went and played tennis while the guys worked out after. And so I think when I think of Smitty, honestly, there was no, what would I say? There was no, there was competition, obviously, because you have to want to be in the goal. You just got to want to help your team. But there wasn't any like cutthroat competition. It wasn't like, you know, oh, I hope Smitty just is awful, you know, for like 10 games and I get to be number one. And, you know, he gets eliminated. And I think it was the same for him. And Al was great about keeping that balance. So, you know, you hear players always say what you want them to say, what they're thinking the fans or the press want to hear. But when Smitty and I talked about being a team, we really were. It's a hard one to imagine because we are so, so different that you would think, how could they get along? But I can say I never really got mad at Smitty. The only time I said to Smitty was one time he butt-ended Dave Semenko in the face. And Dave Semenko was playing for the Oilers. And Dave Semenko grabbed Smitty, and Smitty didn't wear a chin strap. He flipped his helmet off, and he tattooed him right between the eyes. As you can imagine, Dave Semenko, toughest guy in the NHL. He's knocking people out. He just knocked out Ronnie DeLorme, I think, or somebody for Vancouver. It doesn't matter. But that was the only time I kind of said, Smitty, you got to know who you're butt-ending. Because he said to me, who was that guy? I said, I said, Smitty, that's Dave Semenko. He's the toughest guy in the NHL. He knocked the guy out last week. I said, Smitty, you got to start figuring this thing out. You got to know who these guys are. And so it was interesting. For Smitty, he was an incredible goalie, and he doesn't get the credit because Smitty compartmentalized things. For Smitty is, I'm paid to be a goalie. I will play goal with all I've got. I will give my heart and soul to this team. I will do whatever I can to help them win. But that's it. I'm not going to think about hockey all the time. I'm not going to just, you know, like he wasn't into stats. He wasn't into following other teams to learn how the shooters were. Smitty was just a phenom. And people ask me, guys, I had to try to figure out, okay, what should I do in this situation to be the most consistent? What should I do there? Like a 2-on-1, da-da-da-da-da-da. Smitty never had to think about that. He just did it. If you know some people like that, like even Bobby Orr, you say to Bobby Orr, why were you so good? He's, I don't know. I just did it. It just came to me. And that was Smitty. So he didn't study other teams. But I said, Smitty, one thing you better start doing, you better start knowing who the guys are on the other team, because Smitty, you know, could be pretty nasty with his stick. And but that was the only time where I just got a little testy and said, Smitty, come on. Like, you can't live this kind of delusional life where you can just do this to anybody and somebody's going to get you if you keep doing that. But otherwise, it was a beautiful arrangement with Smitty and I. And I got to just tell you one more story, though. That first year, we got Ernie Hickey. And Ernie's on our team. And he was from Regina. I played against him. I honestly, guys, right now I've got two scars from Ernie Hickey hitting me with pucks back when we were playing in Regina. But I said, Billy, is Ernie Hickey driving you crazy? Oh, yeah. Because Ernie would push the puck. We'd do drills where it was just 1-on-0. They'd come up down the wing and they'd slap it. Ernie would push it inside that circle. And, oh, could he shoot it, right? And he says, well, okay. He says, I'll take care of it. He says, I'll take care of it tonight. I thought, well, no, we got a game tonight. Can't take care of it tonight. But Smitty did, because we're in Atlanta and it's warm-ups and Ernie Hickey. Because what we would do, remember, warm-ups back then were nothing like they are now. You usually had one or two pucks, not a bunch, one or two pucks. Guys would skate and stuff and do some of that. Then they'd line up on the blue line, and the defenseman in each corner, the puck would come to them off a save or whatever. They'd shoot it back to a guy in the blue line. He'd come in and shoot. Then they'd get the puck. They'd pass it to the next guy. He'd come in. It really was a very slow warm-up, but I see Ernie gets the puck, and he's pushing that thing slow, and I thought, oop, and all of a sudden, I look at Smitty. Smitty's charging out of the net. Smitty goes into a two-pad slide, but he went down on his side, and he kicked his legs, and Ernie didn't expect it. Ernie Hickey goes flying over him, right? And his stick goes flying. He jumps up. Smitty jumps up. Smitty throws his helmet off. Ernie throws his gloves off. Smitty throws his gloves off. Two guys on the same team grabbing each other. They're going to go at it in warm-up. So all and in the Atlanta Flames, they just stopped and watched. And then, I mean, it's kind of funny. So then all the Islanders jumped in and said, hey, guys, break it up. Da-da-da-da-da. But that was Smitty straightening out Ernie. And Ernie was much better after that, but I don't know if that really solidified their friendship or not. But I got to tell you, I love the NHL now, but you talk about characters from the old days, situations you'd never see now. It's been so polished and homogenized, which I'm not criticizing, but some of the things that happened back in the 70s, well, you just can't believe them. I know I got so many stories, and people say, come on, you must be making that up. And I said, no, that really happened. And so there's one I'm sure that nobody can duplicate, two players on the same team dropping the gloves and going to go at it. But that was the fire of Billy Smith. And love him or hate him, boy, that guy under pressure, he was the reason that, you know, the Islanders won 4 cups. He's in the Hall of Fame. I'm just thankful I got to play with him, and I'm thankful that that those great Islander fans were able to be recipients of one of the greatest goalies of all time.
Now, the run in 1975 to get through the Rangers, to get through the Penguins, required both Smitty and yourself. Can you take us back to those remarkable playoff series, obviously topping the Rangers in that best of three, the first ever playoff series that the Islanders were in, and then the 3-0 comeback against the Pittsburgh Penguins. Then the Islanders almost accomplished the same feat against the Flyers the subsequent round. So just take us overall through that 75 run.
Well, there again, just, you know, following up on us being a team, Smitty and I, we're both trying to establish ourselves, obviously. And we knew, hey, if Smitty was on, he was better than me. But if I was on, it was better than Smitty. So Al, fortunately, because I got hot at the end of that year, and not that Smitty wasn't, but he's okay, you're going to play the first game in the Garden. Well, we won the first game in the Garden, and I played really well. Then we came back to the Coliseum, and it didn't go well. And we wanted it so much. You know, I mean, now for the first time, because it was best out of three, we beat them at home. We're going to the next round, and we're eliminating the great New York Rangers. So I didn't play my best, and we were flat, whatever, maybe nerves. Then we go back to Madison Square Garden. Because we're a team, Al said, okay, Smitty, your turn. Well, he goes in and plays really, really well, and we beat them. Then we go to Pittsburgh, and Smitty starts because he's coming off that game. And he played the first three games and played pretty well. And it was sort of like, I guess, Al's idea. And against the Rangers, was like, okay, Chico had two starts, but I'm going to throw Smitty in now because he wants to prove himself, and he'll be desperate. And it worked. So then Smitty plays three, played pretty well. They're up 3-0. But again, Al's thinking, well, we're in a desperate situation. Chico, let's see what you've got. So I go in, win at home, win in Pittsburgh, come back, win at home. And of course, now I'm going to play the seventh game. And that was one of the greatest feelings of satisfaction, as you can imagine, ever, for not just me, but I remember, I can still remember Al and Bill Torrey and the scouts came in and the, you know, it was just a festive mood in that dressing room in Pittsburgh. And so it was, you know, it was a highlight. And then Al says, okay, Chico, you're going to play the first game in Philly. Lost that game. Then he came back to Smitty, and Smitty lost. And then we came home. He said, okay, I'm going to start Smitty. Smitty lost the first game. Now we're down 3-0. And then Al said, I'm sure he's thinking, okay, Chico's been missing out. He's going to be desperate. And I was. Anyway, make a long story short, we win game one, game two, game three. And then the seventh game, I still remember it. Kate Smith, Gary Dornhoff, for first minute came down. I went to these really thin Vicks sticks. And I, if we were on the video, I could show you an old one. Literally, the old goalie sticks were about a half inch thick. They were clubs. And then this was a period in the early 70s where all these companies were coming up with new innovations. And so I used this really thin stick. And I could remember the shot just as I'm talking to you now. Shot, kick, hear it hit the stick, hear the crowd roaring, thinking, what's going on? I looked down, and the top of my stick had a big chip out of it. It had hit the top of the stick, but it was so thin, and it was a low shot. It hit the stick, and I got most of it, but it flew up and went in right up under the crossbar. And then we lost 3-1, which was disappointing. But so it was an incredible, tough year. And then on the way back on the bus, Al said, hey, Chico, you know, because I'd only played 25 regular season games. He says, Chico, you proved yourself. You know, you train hard. You're going to be one of the goalies with Smitty next year. That was satisfying. Anyway, after that first year in 75, Denny Potvin was terrific. It'd just go down the list. But we knew that we were now in the top, probably in the top 5 to 7, 8 teams in the league. And so there was a lot of confidence coming out of that 75 season.
Chico, speaking of old goalie gear, I've got a soft spot for those old brown pads, and I love when the modern day guys wear that throwback style. So a couple of questions. First, how protected did you feel by those old school pads? Because I've heard stories of goalies not making it out of warmups, and if guys today are still coming out with bumps and bruises, well, I'd think that would probably go double or triple for you back then. And then that playing stand-up style, do you look at that as a lost art or good riddance now that everybody pretty much plays butterfly now?
Well, the old pads, if you got shot right on, straight on, they were fine, but you didn't have anything on the inside of the legs. And of course, we would turn our legs sometimes to make a pad save or skate save. So that's where you felt vulnerable. And you know, budgets were pretty tight. Like you couldn't say, hey, I want a new pair of pads every year. You know, you had to kind of make the best of them. But I'll just finish with the pads. But the one thing about the pads then, when you strapped them on your legs, your knee had to hit the ice to plug the five hole, okay? And that was almost impossible for most goalies. And we'll fast forward, probably to the mid-90s. They put a pad on the inside of the knees. And I remember putting the pad on for the first time, like, I don't know, 91 or 92. I had a perfect butterfly. But when I was playing with the Islanders with those old pads, nobody had a perfect butterfly because you had to go down so far. And now you went down in the 90s and the pad flips up. It's almost like it's got a chip in there that when it hits the ice, the pad flips up. I have a perfect butterfly now at 72. I could go out and make a perfect butterfly. At 22, I couldn't get my butterfly sealed up. So that was the hardest part of those old pads. It wasn't even so much that they weren't protective. And the other thing is they broke down. Remember, it was deer hair, stuffed deer hair in there, not hard fiber like now that holds its shape. And so, you know, that was the one thing. And the reason we played more stand up and kick saves and two pad stacks where you throw your pads is because remember who our coaches were and who we watched. They were all goalies from the 50s and 60s and early 70s who did not wear a mask. Now imagine if Barlamov had no mask and there's a cross ice pass. He's not going in a butterfly face first and going to take that right in the kisser. He's going to throw his pads first, right, and keep his head out of the shot area. And that's what those old coaches would teach. Because in their day, they're not putting their face over where the puck's going to be blasted. So that it was just that we were being taught, we were emulating old goalies. But I remember Al Arbor saying to me, like, when I would get down in a butterfly, I could make, let's say I could make five or six saves low, because most players shoot low more accurately than high. Okay, so I'm down and I made all these saves. But at the end of the game, let's just say I went down and the rebound came and the guy put it up over my shoulder. Al, and I loved Al, would say, hey, you can't stay down on your knees. Get up. He says, you got to stand up. But I'm thinking, but Al, if he shoots while I'm getting up, then I got holes low. And that's where most guys can shoot accurately. Most guys can't hit that top corner. So I'm taking away the percentages, and that's what the butterfly is now. You take away the two-thirds of the lower part of the net. You know yourself, there's only a few guys that can snipe up high. And Al would say to me, Chico, do me a favor. You go home tonight. Could you sleep standing up? Don't lay down in bed, sleep. He was trying to get the impression that, hey, stay on your feet. But I was always struggling because I could see the patterns. And many times I was down in the butterfly. I would hear Al's words, get up, get up. And as I'm getting up, boom, somebody would whack the puck just when I'm getting up and go underneath me or through me. So there was this it wasn't logic. We were being influenced by old players and goalies who played without a mask, and a big part of that was protecting your face. And even your shoulder pads weren't that good back in the early 70s. They were just felt. Oh, you felt a lot of those shots. So wasn't that goalies were stupid then. It's just that it was the physical protection. Then, of course, by the 80s and Patrick Waugh, and then the pads had been changed. They had great equipment. You know, then they just went with percentages because, like I say, you got 18 shooters on the team. I guarantee you, even today, 12 of them, maybe even 14 of them, will be able to be real accurate from the middle of the net down to the ice low, but only about 4 of them can consistently snipe upstairs. And they're the ones like Ovechkin and the guys who score a ton of goals. So that's what goalies figured out was, let's take away the percentage shot that most players could shoot. And the top shooters, okay, you're not going to stop them anyway. And so, you know, that was the evolution of the goalie transition into butterfly. The last thing is, though, what was cool about the old days, I could have put goalies down on the ice with no uniform on, taking you guys in there, and they would have done their style. And I'd say, who's that? You'd say, oh, that was John Davidson. You know, who was that? Oh, that's Bernie Perron. Every goalie had his distinct style that everybody knew, and it was all a little different, much more creative. Now, let's be honest, kind of cookie cutters. Every goalie drops down, butterfly, butterfly push. Yeah, I'm not knocking it because it is about percentages, but it's just another aspect of how there's not that individual creativity and unique style of things that made you recognize right away. I remember one of the great calls, you guys are in radio, that I don't know, it was Marv Albert or somebody said, you know, shot, kick, save, and a beauty. And that was prominent. You never hear that anymore. So the game's never been better, but at the same time, the game has never been more predictable in some ways.
Speaking of broadcasting, the majority of the years since your post-playing career, you've been a broadcaster, started with Minnesota North Stars, then plenty of years with the New Jersey Devils. What have you loved about having that type of connection still to the game and to the fans?
Well, that's a great point because, you know, I always enjoyed the fans, but as an announcer, you know, now you get to interplay. I got to interplay with them. We could talk hockey. You know, I had time to see them, and they heard what I said on the TV and now the radio, or I did Chico Eats for a while. I'd go out to Long Island. The good news was there wasn't as much preparation for the games in terms of, you know, you can't be. One time I waved to the fans. I remember I was in the old Meadowlands with the New Jersey Devils and these two kids, and the same thing with at the Island. People yelling at me, hey, Chico, Chico, Chico. And, you know, I always thought, well, you can't look like you're not concentrating. But at the same time, I can hear them. So shouldn't I at least just give them a little wave? So I did that one time at the rink in New Jersey. And those kids were kind of punching each other in the arm and pointing at me like, hey, he acknowledged us. Hey, he really heard us. You know, so I always wanted to make the fans feel like I was listening to them. I actually appreciated their opinion. And working with Doc Emmerich, who's like, I think I was fortunate to play, and I would argue this with anyone, L. Arbor was the greatest all-around coach. I'm not saying that there hasn't been some coaches that maybe were better bench coaches or this or that, but nobody, as far as personal touch, players loving him. When we had a meet, we had a thing after we all retired, we had a get together, probably 10-year anniversary, and we were all just the players and Al didn't want to talk, and we all wanted him to talk, and we all stood and started to yell, Arbor, Arbor, Arbor. I mean, players were bawling. I mean, Al had the touch to bring us together like no other coach. So I was fortunate, and Al did get up and talk, and it was sweet. But I had, I think, arguably the best coach ever. I won't say there aren't other coaches as good. Barry Trotz, you can't deny that he's right in the class there with Al Arbor. I'm not saying that, but I wouldn't. I'd argue anyone with anyone that anybody was better, but there's coaches that are as good. Okay, so I had best coach, Billy Smith, Hall of Famer, great goalie compliment. Pushed me, taught me. I had so that I get into broadcasting, and who do I get the broadcast with? Mike Emmerich, who taught me about the fans and taking care of the fans. And that's where your enjoyment is, because he said to me, listen, Chico, I don't know how good you're going to be verbiage. I don't know if you're going to have, you know, fancy sayings, or, you know, how some people develop a style. And I don't know about that, but here's what I do know. You can bring enthusiasm. That fan sitting at home, if he's listening and you don't sound enthusiastic, he's thinking, why am I watching this game? That guy's, the announcer's not even fired up. So that was the one lesson I learned. And whether it was a dump in, and I would talk about, oh, what a terrific cross ice dump. So I just was, I've been so blessed, you guys, to feel every part of the hockey experience and to be mentored by some of the greatest people in the game of hockey. I just thank God all the time. I don't know how it happened. I was just an average goalie, but there were times that I rose to these heights by people around me that I still find impossible to really put a finger on how it happened. So I'm not just being humble. I'm just what the way it was. And so that last game on the island, when I got, you know, fans came up to me, pictures taking, it was a great ending. Like, I loved Long Island. My family loved Long Island. Oh, the fans. I mean, I know I'm going on, but you have no idea those early years going into delicatessens and meeting some Islander fans. And, hey, you guys beat the Rangers last night. It was just, it was magical, especially for all of us. We were all young kids, you know, pretty much, except for Eddie Westfall. He was about, and Burt Marshall and Billy McMillan and J.P. Parisi. I'm just trying to think of a few guys I don't want to forget that really helped form those championship teams, even though they weren't there when they it occurred. But, oh, I mean, the New York Islanders' history is one of the greatest stories in sports. And honestly, the fans, oh, they'd come on the ice. I could just go on and on how personable it was with the fans, you know, and just how we all interacted. And I just can't thank you enough for letting me walk down memory lane like this.
And that's the goal. We love hearing the stories and wanted to go back into the past and early days of the franchise, even to recent days. You've still been able to experience from the other side of things with the Devils, but still always been able to appreciate the Islanders side. And we thank you, Chico.
Good talking to you guys. Thanks for everything, you guys. Appreciate it.
Thanks again for joining us on another edition of Talkin' Isles. Please make sure to subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you might listen. You can follow us on Twitter. I am at Greg Picker here.
And I'm at Wright's Way.
And you can follow all the latest info about the team at NY Islanders on Twitter. And stay up to date on UBS Arena at ubsarena.com. Big thank you to our producer, Rachel Lusher, and to WRHU at Hofstra University. And we'll see you next time on Talkin' Isles.